podcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Let me just mention very quickly that tomorrow, Jack Brighton will be sitting in here as host. And the 10 o'clock hour, he'll be talking with Shoshana Sofer, professor of healthcare policy at Baruch College at City University of New York, talking about the consequences of uninsurance. And I expect here what we're talking about is the fact that there are a great many Americans who don't have any health insurance. The second part of the program, he'll talk with Simon Head, who is director of the Project on Technology and the Workplace at the Century Foundation, about a book that he's authored titled The New Ruthless Economy, the subtitle Work and Power in the Digital Age. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour, we'll be talking about politics in the Middle East, specifically in Israel. And our guest for the show is Dr. Meron Medzini. He is a senior lecturer at Tel Aviv University in East Asian Studies and at Hebrew University in Israel Studies. He was born and educated in Jerusalem and also went to school here in the United States. He has a degree in political science from City College, New York, his master's in international relations from Georgetown, PhD in East Asian Studies from Harvard. His main academic interests are in modern Japan, modern Japanese history, and Israel-Japan relations. He also has worked in government in Israel. He's spent a number of years as director of Israel's government press office, has been visiting lecturer various universities in this country, in Canada, elsewhere. He's also former editorial writer for the Jerusalem Post and other daily newspapers in Israel. He's here visiting the campus, his visit sponsored by the Program in Jewish Culture and Society within the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And in fact, he will be giving a talk on the topic Israel after 40 months of Intifada, Winners and Losers. And he'll be speaking this evening at 7:30 in the reading room at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And I assume that anyone interested in hearing him should feel welcome to turn out. And of course, here this morning, if you have questions as we talk, they are welcome too. The only thing we ask is people are as brief as possible, and we ask that so that we can keep our program moving, accommodate as many callers as possible. But anyone's welcome to call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So if you're listening in and around Illinois and Indiana, if it would be a long distance call for you, use the toll free line. In fact, anyone listening, if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll free line. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure. Good morning to you.
I thought I would ask to begin about what seems to be roiling Israeli politics right at the moment, and that is the recent announcement by the Prime Minister, Mr. Sharon, to evacuate all Jewish settlers from Gaza, from the Gaza Strip. And he said, apparently, he was quoted as saying, "I'm working on the assumption that in the future there will be no Jews in Gaza." And it made a lot of people in Israel very angry. What is behind this unilateral move by Mr. Sharon?
He's been talking about this now for the last 2 months, and this is a major change and departure for him, because in many respects he has been the father, the patron of settlements for the last 35 years, including some of the settlements in Gaza. He apparently has come to the conclusion that Israel can no longer wait for the Palestinian Authority or other Palestinian organizations to make up their mind what sort of settlement they envision, and therefore Israel will have to do certain things unilaterally. The fence is one such element. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to start with Gaza. This is not something new. When Rabin and Arafat negotiated the first Oslo agreement almost 11 years ago, the first withdrawal of Israeli troops was from Gaza. In other words, the notion then was Gaza and Jericho first. Rabin, on a number of occasions, spoke about the need to get out of Gaza. It was becoming too costly. You had more troops there guarding the, by now, I think, 7,000 settlers. And the majority of Israelis would be quite pleased to get rid of Gaza. Therefore, in this respect, Sharon is following some of the ideas of Rabin. What is new is that apparently he is determined to go ahead and do it. And if I read correctly the polls, 60% of Israelis are with him. Go ahead and do it. 37 or 35% of Israelis are opposed to the idea, not so much because they love the Gaza Strip, but because they fear this may mean the beginning of some pullback from the West Bank, which certainly has different strategic, emotional, religious, historical connotations.
It seems that this announcement put further downward pressure on Mr. Sharon's approval ratings, when it already weren't terribly good. How does this affect one way or another, do you think, the way that people in Israel think about how well he has done as prime minister?
His ratings have been very low, because he was elected twice on the platform, "I shall bring peace and security, more security than peace." And regrettably, it's not that he has been unable to deliver. I don't think anyone could deliver such a promise. But in the last 3 years and 4 months of uprising, the total number of Israeli dead has been around 950. Which is an unacceptable figure for us. If you translate it into American terms, this would mean anywhere between 35 and 40,000 dead. And that's a huge number. Add to this the number of wounded. And increasingly it became obvious that it's not Sharon who can't handle this. Israel finds it very difficult to deal with essentially urban guerrilla warfare in which civilians are involved. You're not fighting an ordinary army. There is no recognized front line. And above all, there's a great deal of media involvement. You cannot wield all the power that you've got. There are severe limitations, restrictions on what you can do. Americans are now realizing what this is all about in Iraq. There's certain things you can't do. You have the power, you have the weapons, you have the weapon systems and the strength, but there are restraints, there are limitations on certain things that you can do. And therefore Sharon found himself losing grounds at home, also partly in his own party, especially those who felt that he was not tough enough, he was not strong enough on dealing with terror. Hence, he had to come up with a far clearer policy than he indicated in the past. And I think for the last 2 months, we see a more coherent policy on the part of Sharon. We still have to see if it's going to be implemented. I think he will try and implement it. He also has an idea of putting it to a referendum in Israel, which I have, I'm almost convinced that he will win this referendum, maybe to bypass political objections on the part of at least two parties in his coalition, and probably about 25-30% of the members of parliament who belong to his party, who are not very happy with this.
Mr. Sharon himself has been embroiled in some political scandal. He has not been directly implicated. He certainly hasn't been charged with anything. Right. But he's involved sort of indirectly because his sons are directly involved with allegations of bribery and breaking Israeli campaign finance law. And certainly if he were indicted, he would have to step down. And it's my understanding that within Likud, within his party, people are already starting to jockey for position of who is going to be the next leader.
They've been jockeying for positions for the last year and a half, partly because the man is 75. Mm-hmm. And age alone creates demands for a successor. The front runner at the moment is Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. a different Netanyahu than the one that we had. I mean, Netanyahu was prime minister for almost 3 years, and he was put out by the electorate in 1999. A more mature, a more chastened, a more seasoned Benjamin Netanyahu, who in the last year has attempted to basically rebuild, restructure Israel's economy with some success, been a great deal of opposition. But I think we're back more or less to Netanyahu. I do not see in the Labour Party anyone who can really challenge Netanyahu or Sharon.
Mr. Netanyahu is the finance minister.
Right.
And I know that, as you say, there have been some people, I think, who have been very critical of some of his economic policies and, in fact, have gone as far as to say that as damaging to Israel's economy as the Intifada has been, that his economic policy has been more damaging.
Not so much economic policies, rather social policies. What he has been trying to do in some respect is a combination of Thatcherism and Reaganism. Mm. But in the case of Israel, this is compounded by the fact that the Intifada has severely hurt Israel's economy. I believe we have lost every year about $5 billion. Goods and services production, which represents 5% in the gross domestic product, which is a lot. Unemployment has gone up, tourism down, investments down, all this compounded with the crash partly of the high-tech sector, and we were increasingly dependent on high-tech. Therefore, Netanyahu claims, and I think with justifiable, he's right on that, that the first order of priority was to rescue the Israeli economy from a total crash and total collapse. He claims that this almost took place in June of 2002, mm-hmm. for some strange reason. He then argued that this could have happened in the summer of 2003, were it not for his economic policies, plus the American loan guarantee of $9 billion. Israel was able to borrow and tidy itself over. There is certainly criticism because Israel was used to probably a third of the budget went into what is called transfer funds. Old age pension, children allowances, unemployment benefits, medical. You could afford this at the time, let's say in the mid-90s, when we had a budget surplus and when you did not have an uprising. Your defense costs were down. And therefore, there was enormous pressure on the government of Netanyahu as prime minister, then on Barak. If you have surplus, why don't you be generous with it? Raise pensions and benefits and that sort of thing. We can't afford it. We simply can't afford it. And therefore, he is calling for rationalization. The main complaint against him is that increasing segments of the population are hurting, are feeling the pressure, to such an extent that let's say, of 7 million Israelis, about 1.5 million are just on the poverty line. And that includes quite a few children. By the way, mainly Arab, Bedouin, ultra-Orthodox Jewish families. And this is something that we have never experienced before. And that has led to enormous outcry.
One thing that I read was that, and you can correct me if this is not correct, that in Israel, defense spending is 10% of GDP?
Around.
Something like that?
Around.
And that if you take a look at other, what is the average in other European industrial democracies, it's about 2.
Half of that.
It's much less. How much, if indeed Israel could get to the point where it was at peace, how much difference would that make? I mean, how much could you back off on defense spending and put that money into something else?
That country would be paradise. No question about this. I teach Japanese history. One of the reasons for Japanese economic miracle is the fact that for years and years they had no defense budget. Because A, they ruled out use of war. B, they had an American umbrella. Now their defense budget cannot go above 1% of GDP, which in itself is a huge defense budget, but they have a very small army. Regrettably, we have a huge defense budget. The only time that the defense budget was cut in favor of education, welfare, health, and so on was in 1973 under Golda Meir. Then came the war of 1973, and we went back to the bad ways. There is going to be, if the defense budget is cut, this is going to make an enormous difference in infrastructure, in education, higher school, high school, elementary school. This is going to make an enormous difference in the investment in science and technology. At one point, we were investing a great deal. We had to cut. The country will certainly look totally different.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we do have a caller we'll get to. We're speaking with Dr. Meron Medzini. He's senior lecturer in East Asian Studies at Tel Aviv University and also senior lecturer in Israel Studies at Hebrew University. He's here visiting the campus, and we'll be talking this evening, and was good enough to come here and spend some time with us. Your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Bloomington, Indiana, on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I want to talk about press bias against Israel. I think that press bias has hurt the peace process. For example, let me give some ways that the press has just misled the people against Israel. The press has led people to think that the Palestinians constituted a nation which Israel conquered and dispossessed. Now, the truth is, which the press has not made clear, the truth is the Palestinians never were a nation. The land of Palestine, which they are now demanding, that portion that they're not, that the Palestinians are now demanding, the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, those lands never belonged to the Palestinians. The Gaza Strip was part of Egypt. It belonged to Egypt. The Palestinians never owned it. The press does not make that clear. And they also, during the time that Egypt owned the Gaza Strip, there was never any pressure that Egypt should give the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians. No one ever assumed that Egypt ought to give the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians. The West Bank was part of Jordan. And the press never advocated that Jordan should give the West Bank to the Palestinians. In fact, when the Palestinians threatened Jordan, Jordan massacred them. Black September. Rocketed them, turned their tanks loose on them, and nobody complained. Now Israel, of course, captured both the Gaza Strip and the West Bank in the 67 war. And when all of these Arab countries attacked them and would have annihilated them, Israel captures those lands. And immediately the press says, hey, you've got to give the Palestinians constitute a nation, and you've got to give the Gaza Strip and the West Bank to the Palestinians, and we will recognize them as a nation. They never were a nation. They're not a nation now.
All right, point made. I follow your drift. Let me answer this.
Yeah.
I spent 15 years of my life dealing with the press and media, especially foreign press in Israel. I can assure you of one thing. Many of the things that you say are right, but that doesn't get us anywhere. The media does not hurt the peace process. On the contrary, the media played an important role in the events leading, let's say, to 91, the Madrid conference. The media was very fair in dealing with us on the eve of the Six-Day War. The media was very fair in dealing with us in the Gulf War when we were asked not to become involved. The media was, by and large, fair during the Second Gulf War. I would not ascribe to them all the evils that you think they are displaying. It is true, we are not always very happy, sometimes very angry. with what the media is doing. That's part of the game. The media cannot go into ancient history. I'll never forget CNN. I think it was CNN or Fox News. They told me simply, we have 1 minute, 40 seconds for an item. We cannot go into ancient history. There's no time for that. We have to show action. We have to show color. We have to show things exploding. We have to show blood.
Yeah.
And that's the name of the game. You will have to take it with a lot of grain of salt. Therefore, my argument is very simple. The media has a role to play. The present uprising, to a large extent, is an uprising of perceptions, a struggle for perception. The media plays a very important role. Not all of it is biased against Israel. You're lucky you live here, and I do not assume that you read the European press. Compared to the American press, the European is far more problematic. But even then, there are differences. The main point I want to make to you is this. As long as Israel remains a working democracy, which means freedom of the press, free access to correspondents, local and foreign, to where the action is, virtually no censorship, Israel will pay a price for these freedoms. Democracy, by its nature, does not always help public relations. It would be much easier for public relations if you're operating in a dictatorship. We're not. And we know we're paying a price. I think it's worthwhile. And I'm also upset on occasion, but we've come a very long way. At some point, we were very angry. I think by now we have a more balanced view of what the media is doing.
Well, let me ask you specifically about the coverage of the current intifada. I think that some people have complained about coverage and have – very specifically, they said that the media, in the way that they cover Israeli – you know, actions of the Israeli military against Palestinians – and the way that they cover suicide bombings, and that somehow there is the coverage seems to be saying that, that somehow one is more egregious than the other. What do you think about that? Yeah.
We are not very – we, a number of Israelis, are not very happy with the way the present uprising has been covered, partly because – the foreign press, which covers the West Bank and Gaza, in order to retain their sources, in order to retain possibility of working within these territories, in order to retain their contacts with Palestinian Authority, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, are prepared to lean backwards and are prepared to, in fact, accept certain demands by Palestinians. Don't show this. Don't film this. We will confiscate that part and so on. We saw this when there was a lynch. Two Israeli reserve soldiers strayed into Ramallah. They were lynched, literally lynched. An Italian cameraman captured this, and he aired it. The local correspondent of the Italian state radio and television, RAI, wrote a letter to the Palestinian Authority saying, sorry, it wasn't me. Somebody else is not affiliated with us, and so on. Which, of course, got our back up. Why are you apologizing? There was a lynch. They're also able to operate freely in Israel, and therefore there are double standards. And this we are very annoyed with. And I'll give you an example. I mentioned this to you before. A Daily Illini this morning in top headline, 15 killed in Gaza skirmish, huge letters. Third headline below, much smaller, dozens die in suicide bombing. This is poor reporting. This is poor editing. This is poor judgment. 100 people were killed in Iraq in the last 2 days by Iraqis. And therefore, this leads you to the conclusion when Arabs kill Arabs, either no news or news of less significance. When the Israeli army goes into Gaza and 15 are killed, that commands the top headline. This, we feel, is bias. This is bad. This is not right.
Let's talk with another caller. Line number one, Urbana. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to comment briefly on the previous caller. None of the countries presently found in the Middle East to have historical justification for their boundaries. Iraq is a creation of the British and French, as are most of the other nations there today. And to make the generalizations he made that there is no Palestinian people really is pointless. His statement that it was part of Egypt is quasi-true. They were both part of the Ottoman Empire, which the French and British carved up. As to placing the Palestinians back in a union with the Jordanians, that really is a pointless idea. I think we have two choices, either two states, Israel and a Palestinian state, or one state combining both, which I think would really be preferable, but impossible.
Can I comment on what you said?
Yes, please.
You know, in some respects, you're echoing what Saddam Hussein argued on the eve of 1991 when he occupied Kuwait. He had
justification for what he said, although I'm totally opposed to what he did.
He said that all the borders were the creation of colonial French and British colonialism, but he did something else. He challenged the legitimacy of every single Arab ruler but himself. And this is why Egypt and Syria and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and others joined the American coalition. Now, on the Palestinians, Israel has recognized the Palestinian people. Israel has recognized, in fact, the Palestinian nation, not only in the Oslo Agreement, but in subsequent understandings and agreements. Secondly, Israel has accepted the creation of a Palestinian state. And that includes the present Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Sharon. He said, yes, there's going to be a two-state solution, as envisaged initially by what is called the Bush vision of June 2002, and more recently by the roadmap, which happens to be the only viable plan on the table at the moment.
I would disagree. There's also the Geneva plan.
No, the Geneva Initiative is a private exercise, and the Geneva Initiative, incidentally, has been rejected by most Israelis. I don't know about how many Palestinians. Arafat certainly has not endorsed it. I have read every word of the Geneva plan. I can assure you it's bad. It's bad for many reasons. We don't have time to go into it. Geneva plan is, it's called the initiative. It's a non-starter. Look, there are many other plans. Tenet, Mitchell, Sharon, Clinton, the Barak plan. I can give you a whole list of plans. At the moment, what is on the table acceptable to Israel, Palestinians, the Americans, Europeans, UN, Russian Federation, is what is called the roadmap. Unfortunately, nothing came out of it at this stage of the game. Maybe something eventually will. I have my doubts. So our question is, history is very important, but where do we go from here? What's going to happen tomorrow?
I think that's essentially what I said. That, yes, there is no historical basis. Your previous caller would have said that Israel has a right to the whole of the Palestinian area because, in his view, your people must all return to his land before the second coming can come.
No, I don't remember him saying that.
Well, he has on previous instances.
Previous, I don't know.
And I think you recognize his rhetoric well enough to know this is where it's coming from. But anyway, that's not the point.
It's neither here nor there.
But that is his basis for what he is saying.
Fine. We heard him. We heard you.
All right.
All right, well.
I think we both made our point, and I appreciate your point, and I wish you would go on. Thank you.
All right. Well, we will indeed. We'll go to another caller in Belgium, near Danville. Not the country, but not too far away from here, on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to just make the point that your caller stated, you know, not your caller, your interviewee, stated just a couple of minutes ago about the way that things are presented in the press, in the media. He was speaking about various things that have gone on here recently. I seem to remember back in the 80s, late 70s, that there would be attacks on Israeli soldiers that would involve some problems, and they would put that on front page. But when it came to the number of young boys throwing rocks that were killed, they would be put on the last page. It's been a problem in this area for a long time. Thank you very much.
All right. Again, you have comment on that?
Yeah, you're welcome. Look, reporting is always a very tricky thing. Partly, it depends on what happens on that day, what other news is there, also who is reporting, what is the knowledge, experience, background of whoever is reporting on Middle Eastern affairs, what is the judgment of the editor or the night editor or copy editor, whoever is happens to decide where the story goes into. Sure, there have been a number of cases when the Israeli side was presented in one way, the Palestinian side presented another way. I am fairly relaxed and calm. I don't get overexcited because where this goes into a newspaper. I'll give you one example. There was a massive earthquake in Israel yesterday, 4.9 on the Richter scale. Mm-hmm. We haven't had such an earthquake since 1927. And I didn't see it. It wasn't. CNN gave it about 5 seconds. Didn't see it in the media this morning. Has nothing to do with Palestinians, nothing to do with Israelis. It involved the West Bank. It involved Lebanon. It involved Israel. Not much reporting on it. So we have to take it in our stride, not get overexcited about this.
We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest I'd like to introduce again, Dr. Meron Medzini. He's a senior lecturer at both Tel Aviv University and at Hebrew University. At Tel Aviv, he is a lecturer in East Asian Studies, and that is his main academic field. Also, he's a lecturer in Israel Studies at Hebrew University. He has a PhD in East Asian Studies from Harvard University. And as he said a little bit earlier, he spent a number of years as director of Israel's government press office. He has been visiting lecture at various universities in this country, also Canada, Australia, Singapore, and has been former editorial writer for the Jerusalem Post and other daily papers in Israel. He's here visiting the campus, a visit sponsored by the program in Jewish Culture and Society within the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. He'll be giving a talk on the topic Israel after 40 months of Intifada, Winners and Losers, tonight, 7:30 in the reading room at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And anyone's welcome to attend. I have read some articles recently suggesting that maybe there are fewer people in Israel who actually do believe in a two-state solution anymore. You think that still is something people actually believe can happen?
Yes. I suspect that among Israelis, probably 30 to 40% are not sure whether this is the right solution. The majority will go along. But there is still a very strong minority that says no way. Hmm. God's given country, historic rights, religious rights, anyone who alienates territory is committing a major sin and in putting the country at risk. As long as the other side has not come to terms, not recognized, much deeper than that, come to terms, has gone through a major psychological change in its attitude towards the very concept of a separate entity called Israel. That is basically our major problem. It's not recognition, it's acceptance. And that takes much longer, and that has to do a great deal with psychological change, educational change. That's going to last for generations.
something else that we talked a little bit earlier about Mr. Charon's announcement that his intention was to remove the settlers from Gaza, has also talked about taking, I'm not sure if he's talking about all or he's talking about some of Israel's Arab population and making them part of this Palestinian state.
Not Charon. I am not Charon. I'm not aware that Charon has at any time suggested a exchange of population. There are other Israelis who have come up with the idea of an exchange of population and territory. Something, incidentally, that has a historic precedent. There was an exchange of population between Turkey and Greece in 1922-1923. So this theoretically can be done. For example, there is a certain area in Israel, not far from where the wall is now, it's called the Little Triangle, where there is a Israeli-Palestinian population of probably 250,000 people. And some Israelis have been saying, why shouldn't they be part of the Palestinian state? The territory will be part of the Palestinian state in return for an exchange of territory where there will be three main settlement blocks that will go to Israel. The settlement block idea has been endorsed by the U.S., both Clinton and Bush, and is part of the roadmap. I have my enormous doubts whether the Palestinians, the Israeli Arabs, have any intention of living in a Palestinian authority. In fact, most of them reject the idea outright, saying, thank you very much, we are Israeli Arabs, we're Palestinians, we'd rather live in Israel than live under Arafat or whoever succeeds.
The issue that some people point to is demographic trends that suggest that if things keep going as they are, one day Jews could be a minority in Israel. And apparently there are some Israelis that are worried about that.
And there are many Israelis who are worried about that. And this is one of the major reasons for the construction of the barrier or the fence or the wall, whatever you want to call it. And this is why increasing number of Israelis are saying, let us separate unilaterally or disengage. Otherwise, Israel will cease to be a Jewish state. And that is something that is worrying more of us increasingly. Certainly true.
Well, we have some other callers. Let's go to Danville and line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I have a question. What are the requirements to become a citizen of Israel, and do you have to be of the Jewish faith?
If you are a Jew, you come in under the law of the return, and more or less automatically you become an Israeli citizen. If you are a non-Jew, depending on who you're married to, depending, theoretically you can come under family reunification plan, or you can apply for Israeli citizenship. It takes time, but I remind you that of the 7 million people living in Israel proper, not excluding territories, 1.2, about 20%, are not Jews, Christians, mainly Muslims, Druze, Circassians, and 20% is a huge non-Jewish population, and they're there. There are others who come and apply and can become Israeli citizens. I don't remember the exact details. You have to apply, Ministry of Interior, and so on. But this is happening virtually every day.
Champaign County, next, line 2. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, you talked about the loan guarantee, the $9 billion refinancing, but it wasn't widely commented on. Maybe it's because it's so inconsequential, but there was a tranche of $263 million that was held back by the Bush administration, kind of like the previous Bush administration, to evince some disapproval. I think it wasn't about the wall. It was more about certain settlements.
Mainly settlements.
But I
don't know if the figures are exact, but yes, they withheld because of settlements. Yes.
But it's less than it's less than a percent actually of the $9 billion refinancing. But I guess it was sort of new money. But it wasn't widely commented on here. I still wonder whether it's just because it's sort of inconsequential. It doesn't even mean $273 million was held back. It just means that the refinancing had to go at a higher
I don't
cost.
Know the technicalities. Here, it may not have received play. In Israel, it certainly did, because it's an expression of displeasure. And Israel has a number of disagreements with the United States on settlements, on the wall, on the meaning and nature of Israeli security, on American arms sales to the Middle East, on Israeli arms sales abroad. There is a series of disagreements, and occasionally they flare up, and this is one of the manifestations.
It seems to me this whole argument about press is, I don't know what government you were, whether you were civil service, but press here is wretched. It's always quite favorable. One thing that hasn't been noted is by the press and is that the current Bush administration doesn't condemn the so-called targeted assassinations, the killings anymore. That they sort of had a perfunctory way of doing that in the past, but they don't anymore, it seems, and there's no, very little comment that
You know when this displeasure ended? On 9/12. You had 9/11.
No, there were condemnations after that. I think maybe it was more related to the fact that the U.S. is now running a occupation in
Iraq.
In Iraq,
and
so
doing more or less the same thing.
Yes.
More or less the same thing. Look, it's not no longer a matter of geography. It's when you're faced with a similar situation, you act in certain ways to ensure the safety of your civilians, of your forces. In the case of Israel, it's mainly civilians, not troops. In the case of Iraq, U.S. troops, because there are hardly any civilians. But we feel very strongly that prior to 9/11, there were questions being asked about the scope and magnitude dimension of the Israeli response, Israeli reaction, you're overreacting, it's out of proportion, and so on. All this ended on 9/11 in the morning.
Well, that's
regrettably.
The plans for going after Iraq predate the 9/11. 9/11 was just a pretext, but that's our own policy, and why we're in that situation needs to be examined. And
not for me to comment. I'm a guest in this country.
Yeah. Well. I'm trying to make. As long as you brought up the analogy, we need to know why the territorial. The territories are so important. This historical, I don't know what the historical, it's only a religious
no,
basis.
The territory is important also from a strategic point of view. Imagine for a moment that you will have hostile territory 6 miles from O'Hare Airport, or hostile territory, it was 14 miles from your major urban center, which is Tel Aviv. This is why we are terrified about the proximity of Palestinian territory to certain Israeli areas, not all of them, some of them, because we've had, regrettably, an attempt on one of our planes, not in Israel, in Kenya. And therefore, we are very, very concerned over this sort of thing. You just have to remember the previous line, the armistice demarcation line of 49-67, to see how narrow the waist of Israel is, and therefore what is our concern.
Maybe it's productive to ask you directly about how you feel about the so-called fence barrier.
I am very much in favor.
But on the not being on the green line.
Never mind the green line.
Never
mind the green line. Green line was an armistice demarcation line, not a final political border, specifically stated, if you want the chapter and verse, paragraph 5 of Israel-Egypt armistice agreement, this line is not to be construed as final political border. And therefore, whenever people say this was the border, this is the legal border, no, it wasn't. It was recognized as such by only two countries, Pakistan and Britain. Britain, I can understand Pakistan, I don't remember why. Not a single Arab country recognized this as the final border. In other words, to be negotiated.
Yeah, but if you put a fence up, that's sort of de facto.
Fence can change. Mm-hmm. Fence can change. Easiest thing is to move fences about.
Well, the U.S. role is what I'm preoccupied with, and that's why the attention that it gets here, or should get more attention, that's why it's important, yeah. Because we are underwriting the occupation, et cetera.
I'm not sure if you're underwriting the occupation, but it certainly should get attention here, and I think it does.
I'm jumping in here. We have only about 7-8 minutes left, and certainly if there's somebody else out there wants to call real quick, I can, and we'll try to get him in. We have talked about the conflict here we're talking about has been going on for a long time, and as you pointed out, time after time, proposals have been made to settle it. Why? What's lacking? Why is it that so to date none of these attempts have worked?
Because increasingly people have come to the conclusion that the core issue is not occupation. The core issue is the refusal of, A, the Muslim world, that's 57 countries, B, the Arab world, that's 21 countries, maybe with the exception of Egypt, Jordan, to come to terms with the idea of a separate entity in the Middle East called Israel, a Jewish state, Zionist state. And the argument has never been over square miles or over territory. It's the principle. And in recent years, the trend has been, and this is reflected increasingly by Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Iran, Libya, some of the other more radical Islamic countries, to argue that the existence of Israel is anathema, and Israel should go the way the Crusaders did. And we do not accept this argument, and we have no intention of going the way the Crusaders did or anyone else did. And therefore, you have here a conflict which is historic, religious, emotional. It involves economics. It involves territory. It involves refugees. It involves rights. It involves rate of development. It involves, in fact, more recently, we have become little Satan, and big Satan is the Western world and America. The struggle against Israel increasingly is part of a global Islamist struggle against the West. Israel is seen as an outpost of the West in the Middle East, and therefore it has to go. We disagree. This is not an ordinary struggle. This is not an ordinary struggle in the terms the borders will be here, some refugees will be there. Thank you very much. It involves Jerusalem, for example, which is a city holy to 1.25 billion Muslims, 13 million Jews, to 1 billion Roman Catholics, to untold hundreds of millions of Protestants. All of them will have to be involved at some point in the resolution. It's not strictly Israeli-Arab. Hence the complexity. And then I can assure you of something else in order to make your day nice. Let's say there will be a resolution of the Arab-Israel conflict. Will this end the Syrian occupation of Lebanon? Not necessarily. Will this end Islamist attempt to take over Saudi Arabia? No, not connected. Will this end the attempt by Libya to remain an Islamic state? Will this end the enmity of Iran? In other words, there are many developments in the Middle East totally unrelated, unconnected to Israel. I remind you, there was a war which lasted 8 years between Iraq and Iran. It had nothing to do with Israel. So you have to think of a broader situation where there are inter-Arab rivalries, a rivalry between America and the European Union. Increasingly, we are now part of, call it the War of Civilizations, Islamism versus the West, Israel seen as an outpost of the West.
We'll try and squeeze one more caller in here quickly. Line two. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering, what are the borders of the state of Israel?
The borders of the state of Israel are as follows. The Mediterranean Sea, no contest. The borders between Israel and Egypt are marked in the Israel-Egypt peace treaty. Mm-hmm. The borders between Israel and Jordan, from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, are marked. by the virtue of peace treaty. The borders between Israel and Lebanon are recognized because at some point Israel signed a treaty with Lebanon.
Well, actually, Israel didn't sign any treaty with Lebanon.
Israel signed a end-of-war treaty with Lebanon, which Lebanon never ratified. The date is 17th May 1983.
Borders time, which are... During that time, Lebanon was under occupation.
It wasn't under occupation. Lebanon was under military presence of Israel in about 20% of Lebanon, certainly not in Beirut.
Including the capital, actually.
No, Beirut, Israel has left Beirut. Look, I was there. I remember very well. I remember when we left Beirut. What is not determined are the borders, West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights. Therefore, I would say that north, west, south, and much of eastern borders of Israel are determined and recognized. What remains open, West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights.
Does that answer your question, caller?
Well, yeah. Thank you.
All right. We're at the point here we're going to have to stop. We've used our time. For people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Dr. Meron Medzini, from senior lecturer both Tel Aviv University and Hebrew University. He'll be giving a talk this evening at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus, Israel After 40 Months of Intifada, Winners and Losers. His visit here sponsored by the Program in Jewish Culture and Society in the College of Liberal Arts here at University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Delighted to be here.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, Gallery of Imaginative Jewelry and Gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That is it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. Of course, much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, the story of a Sudanese woman who was kidnapped and sold into slavery. Mende Nazar will be our guest following the 1 o'clock news. Joining her will be journalist Damian Lewis. The two are the authors of a book about Mende's 7 years in slavery. The title is Slave, My True Story. That's coming up today following the 1 o'clock news. It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time, 23 degrees in Urbana. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. March wheat, 388.5, unchanged. July wheat, 385.5, up 0.5. March corn, 282.25, down 2. July corn, 290.75, that down 2.25. September corn, 285.5, down 1.5. December corn, 281.75, down 2. March soybeans, 825.5, that down 12.5. May, 826, down 12.5. November beans, down 3/4 at 654. March soybean meal, 243.20. Make that 243.20, down 4.80. March oil, 31.95, down 19. March feeder cattle, 82.